how David's preparation for his new job is coming along. How would you think that a guy that's going to be the king of a nation, Israel in this particular case, how do you think he would be prepared by God for that role? Maybe a warrior, maybe some lessons in leading large groups, you know, managing people, managing issues and problems and things of that sort. Perhaps being a warrior because of the nature of the battles back at that time. Something like that's kind of what you would expect, wouldn't you? That makes a little sense anyway. Is that how David was prepared for his new job?
He's a shepherd.
No, he wasn't prepared that way, was he? He was prepared as a musician. Well, how many musicians get to be king? Not many, huh? You wonder where he learned. And by the way, some translations translate harp into a lyre so that it's a guitar-like thing instead of a harp. So it would make a little more sense for a guy laying out in the boonies around a bunch of sheep all the time, wouldn't it? To have a little guitar, be a little easier to carry and so on. So that may be what he actually has. And over the period of his life, he composed at least 73 tunes. They're called Psalms in your Bible. There's 150 of them, and he composed nearly half of them. So he's not only musically inclined, but he's a very good composer, very good writer of music as well. And that's how he was actually introduced into Saul's court, wasn't it? Remember, he didn't appear on the surface first time as a warrior, as a battler, or anything like that, or an administrator, or any of the things you might expect from a guy that's going to be leader of a nation. He appeared as a musician to try to help Saul deal with some mental problems that he was having. Saul is unfortunately suffering some mental deterioration as the storyline goes forward here, and he was being bugged by an evil spirit so that he was kind of exhibiting sort of like bipolar characteristics. I'm sure that's not technically what it was, but something like that. He was kind of swinging from one end to the other in his emotional extremes and his mental state. He needed some help, and that's how David came on the scene. But that's not the way David stayed in the picture, did it? He didn't remain kind of musician extraordinaire, because he got into this fight with this big guy. And he put a number on that big guy, Goliath, killed him, and David then was sort of introduced to the nation, not as a musician, but as a warrior, as a battler who could kill this great foe of Israel, Goliath, and he did. So he began as a musician, but he kind of fairly quickly, I think, transitioned into more of a warrior's role in Saul's monarchy. We saw the detail of that thing last week, David killing Goliath. And as a result of that, the Israelis, they kind of whipped up on the Philistines pretty heavily, took off after them and killed a whole bunch of them and took their armament and their equipment and all that sort of things, and had quite a impressive victory as a result of David's killing of Goliath. Now, hopefully when we pick up the narrative this week, he's put that head down somewhere that he was carrying around with him. We don't need that thing around too much longer, do we? He probably did. So what happens after that? Well, that's where chapter 18 takes us. So let's pick the trail up here in 1 Samuel 18. It came about when he had finished speaking to Saul. That's after Saul inquired as to whose family David was from, so he could, in theory at least, give him the rewards that was promised to David. It would be free of taxation. So when he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. This is Saul's number one son. They have a very tight relationship. Now, some people argue that Jonathan was like 20 years older than David. That's kind of weird sounding to me. And what do you think? A little bit on the odd side. Esther's husband, Monty, has a commentary on the life of David, and he goes through a number of arguments in regards to what was the age differential between Jonathan and David. And he concludes that it was about 5 years, that Jonathan was about 5 years older than David. And I'm going to hide behind his scholarship on this because that's always a safe place to be, and that's how I'm going to think of these two. So Jonathan, I think, was maybe about 5 years older than David, and he has a great deal of affinity for David. They're kind of like one another. These guys are both battlers. They both have some spiritual sensitivity to the things that God is doing and so on. So they're kind of like soulmates, two of a kind. So Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. So David's not a shepherd anymore. He is a member of Saul's court and is assisting in the administration of the nation Israel. So then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. Now what Jonathan is doing here by this act of giving his garments to David is that he is saying, in effect, I accept you, David, as the rightful next heir to the throne here in Israel. The kingdom is going to be yours. Remember when Saul and Samuel had that last encounter and Saul and Samuel went away, David grabbed his robe and tore it, and Samuel used that as an example of the kingdom being torn from him. So the robe and the garments that Samuel had on represented the kingdom, and Saul, in essence, was having it taken away from him in that meeting. This is a similar sort of thing here. So the symbology here is that David recognizes, Jonathan recognizes that David is the next heir to the throne there in Israel. And he is willing to accept that and to serve David in that role. Now, there may be another motive that Jonathan is working toward here, and that is, oftentimes when a new king would come on the throne in some of these places, they'd kill off everybody else that was possibly a threat to their kingdom. Anybody who had any claim at all on it would oftentimes be killed off, okay? So Jonathan may be trying to protect his own family, his own descendancy, by making sure David understands that he, Jonathan, is willing to support and be loyal to David. So he does this. So Jonathan seems to have no problem. Maybe he sees in his father the things that we're picking up as we're going along, and he knows that there's a problem there, and that David is ultimately going to be the next king, and so he's willing to make this gesture on his part there. So that's what that's all about. So David went out wherever Saul sent him, and he prospered. And Saul set him over the men of war. Boy, David gets promoted to Secretary of the Army right away. He's over all of Saul's military endeavors. That's a pretty good start point, isn't it, in an army, in a nation like this. And it was pleasing in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Everybody was okay with that. They liked having David in charge. He's displaying the kind of characteristics that they want to see in a military leader. And this is a shepherd, right? This is a guy who, I don't know, a month or two or three ago, he's out there bouncing rocks off of critters that are threatening his sheep, stuff like that. He's not a warrior. He's not a military man. He's not a strategist of any kind. But here he is in charge of the army. His ascendancy is phenomenal. And it happened as they were coming, when David returned from killing the Philistines, that's Goliath, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. And the women sang as they played and said, well, there was the number one song on the hit parade that year was sung by the Israeli Chicks, And the name of it is, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. So they come up with this song that greatly exalts David over Saul. Who's the king? Saul thinks he is. And David is his grunt. And the song honors David greatly at Saul's expense. Well, you could respond to that, I suppose, if you were in Saul's sandals in more than one way. You could say, well, the whole nation's recognizing this guy as a great leader, and he's my guy. I'll just use him to succeed and to do things and help support him and maybe give him a little training on the job and stuff like that. We can make this thing work. Or you can do what Saul does. He's terribly jealous at the honor being shown to David at his expense. He becomes very angry at this in verse 8. For this saying displeased him. He didn't like the Israeli chicks honoring David and kind of ignoring him. They've ascribed to David 10,000, and to me they've ascribed thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? What else is this guy going to acquire other than their esteem and honor? And Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. So following the killing of Goliath and the routing of the Philistines, David and Saul's relationship deteriorates badly. Now there's a couple of different Sauls in the Bible, and there's a parallel between the two of them that I want to point out to you. The New Testament Saul, who we call Paul, had this teacher named Gamaliel. He was kind of rabbi numero uno of his day. Best teacher around, most notable teacher around. Well, in Acts chapter 5, Peter is taken captive by the Sanhedrin. And they told him, don't even speak in the name of Christ anymore. Do not promote this new entity called the church out there that you're doing, Peter. Don't do that. And they said, well, Peter, we're just going to have to punish you severely for doing that. And Gamaliel, the teacher of Paul, speaks up to the Sanhedrin, and he tells them in Acts chapter 5, he says, look, guys, leave these people alone. Do not oppose them, because if this movement, it was called the Way back then, that's kind of an early name for the church, if this movement of Christianity that we call it today, if it's anything, if it's not from God, it will just evaporate and blow away and there won't be anything to it. So don't worry about it. And he cited two examples of guys that tried to develop some movement in the past that didn't go anywhere to illustrate his point. And then he said, but if it is of God, if it is a work of God that these men are about, and you try to oppose it, you're going to get ran over. You're standing in front of an ongoing freight train if this is a legitimate godly movement. So his counsel was, leave them alone. Do not oppose this work of God. You will regret it if you do. Now, Paul is his student. Did Paul follow his advice? Did Paul leave Christianity alone? No, he tried to stamp it out. He tried to eliminate it from off the face of the earth, didn't he? And he was fortunate in that the Lord had a job for him and brought him to faith and used him mightily, as we know how the story kind of goes from there. The Old Testament Saul makes the same mistake. He too opposes a work of God in the life of David. So both the Old Testament Saul and the New Testament Saul make the same mistake. They both oppose the working of God in lives that are all around them there. This Saul is not going to be as fortunate. The Old Testament Saul is not going to be as fortunate as the New Testament Saul. He's not going to get brought into the fold and used mightily by God. But he's making the same mistake. His namesake in the New Testament makes the same mistake that he makes here. He is suspicious of, he is jealous of, he has become the enemy of God's man, the guy that God is going to work through to bring about the new kingdom. So, both of them make the same mistake. Jealousy, animosity, acrimony characterize both of them. One of them turns out okay, one of them will not. All right, so it came about on that the next day that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of the house while David was playing the harp with his hand, as usual, and a spear was in Saul's hand. And Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I'll pin David to the wall. Remember why I called this bipolarism? I mean, look at this guy. One minute he's saying this guy's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and the next minute he's trying to kill him, trying to pin him to the wall with a spear. And he tried twice here. And David escaped his presence twice. David's too nimble for him, so he gets away. This guy's losing it big time, isn't he? Trying to kill him after just expressing gratitude and favor for him earlier in killing of Goliath and the routing of the Philistines. He tries this, by my count, 10 times. Most commentators say 9. We can defer to them. We can call him a cat and say he's got 9 lives, and Saul tries to take his life 9 times. Here's 2 of them right here. This crazy Saul is trying to kill David, the guy he just put in charge of all of his army because of his admiration and respect for him. And Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him, but departed from Saul. Well, that's sensible, isn't it? To fear a man that God is working through because he's not working through you. So Saul is reacting an awful lot now to fear. Fear of David and what David might proceed to do in the kingdom. Therefore, Saul removed him from his presence and appointed him as his commander of 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. So he's not hanging around Saul's office anymore, playing tunes on his lyre or whatever it is. Saul is putting him out in the action, probably in hopes that the action will go against him. Get this guy out of here, put him out there where the danger is, and let him function. And here's the key verse, chapter 18. And David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. That's the whole essence of chapter 18. This young man has God working for him. The Lord was with him to make him prosper, to help him succeed. And when Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him. Saul hates the fact that God is prospering David. But all Israel and Judah loved David, and he went out and came in before him. So the Israeli chicks got it right. David is being loved and honored by the nation. They like his character and the things that he is doing, and clearly God is working through him. And Saul is just slipping further and further down that mentally deteriorating slope that he's on. So things are going downhill now in this relationship, to be sure. So Saul uses a new technique. He can't hit him with a spear. I guess he ain't that good. David's too agile and gets away. So he tries to use his own daughters as pawns in this chess game of trying to kill David. So he offers his oldest daughter, Merab. He says, I'll give her to you as a wife. Only be a valiant man for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul thought, my hand shall not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. So he thinks if he can trade his daughter to David in marriage and David be his battler, his fighter extraordinaire, that the Philistines will get him. Sooner or later, the Philistines will kill the guy. But David's response, and perhaps he is more insightful than Saul thinks, he says, well, who am I, and what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be the king's son-in-law? In other words, he's basically saying, hey, I don't have the dowry money for this marriage. The family doesn't have it. This is not going to work. I can't do this. I can't begin to take on a role like that. So it came about at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David that she was given to Adriel, the Meholathite, for a wife. So that rat Saul gives his daughter to somebody else. It doesn't work out some kind of a dowry arrangement that David could afford or his family could afford and do something. He just gives her to another guy. Would you buy a used car from Saul? I don't think his word too trustworthy right now, is it? And David knows it. But Saul has another daughter. Her name is, I'm going to call her Michal. I don't know how that's supposed to be pronounced. It's probably not Michal, but I'm going to call her that. Now, Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. Now, she apparently legitimately loves the guy. The first daughter, she's just a pawn being used by Saul to try to entice him. Didn't matter what she thought of him. But the second daughter here, Michal, she loves David. And when Saul finds out about this, it was okay with him. She thought, I can use this one now. Saul thought, I'll give her to him so that she may become a snare to him and that by the hand of the Philistines will be against him. In other words, he's thinking out loud here, you know, if I can make this guy my son-in-law using my second daughter, the Philistines will try even harder to kill this guy because they would really love to kill the son-in-law of the king. So I'll get him hooked up here with my second daughter. She's just as unloved, apparently, as the first one. So therefore, Saul said to David, for a second time, you may be my son-in-law today. So he's offering a second daughter to try to bring harm to David by his new position there. So Saul commanded his servants, speak to David secretly, saying, behold, the king delights in you, and all his servants love you. Now therefore become the king's son-in-law. So he tells all the servants to try to lather David up, sucker him into going ahead and marrying Michal, because, hey, Saul really, really likes you. He really wants you as a son-in-law. Go on and marry his daughter there, guy. So Saul's servants spoke these words to David, but David said, is it trivial in your sight to become the king's son-in-law since I am a poor man and lightly esteemed? Hey, guys, it's just simply this ain't going to work. I got nothing. I'm nobody from nowhere. I have no money. And I'm going to become the king's son-in-law? And so the servants of Saul reported back to him, according to these words which David spoke. So they relay back to him that David feels inadequate and can't afford this and so on. So then Saul says, thus you shall say to David, the king does not desire any dowry. That is, David, you don't have to pay a bunch of bucks to marry my daughter. All I want is 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take vengeance on the king's enemies. And Saul planned to make David fall by the hand of the Philistine. So the dowry in this bizarre case is that he just wants David to bring him the body parts of 100 Philistines. So all David has to do is go out and kill 100 of these guys, take their foreskins and bring them to Saul. That's the dowry, David. You don't have to have any money. Just go out there and take your sword and get me these body parts. Figuring that some Philistine would get him in the process, right? 100 guys? He's going to kill 100 guys? Now, David, he's not that stupid. He knows what's going on here. When his servants told these words, it pleased David to become the king's son-in-law. In other words, he said, okay, that's a piece of cake. I can do that. I ain't got no money, but I can go kill these 100 Philistines. This is a shepherd, one or two, three, 4 months ago. This is a guy who readily accepts this offer because all he's got to do is kill 100 Philistines to get it. And before the days had expired, David rose up and went, he and his men, and struck down 200 men among the Philistines. So he didn't just get the 100 that Saul required for a dowry. He kills 200 of them just to make sure there's no shortage or anything. David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full number to the king, and that he might become the king's son-in-law. So Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, for a wife. When Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. Then Saul was even more afraid of David. Thus Saul was David's enemy continually. I mean, when you ask the guy to go get 100 body parts for you for a dowry and he goes out and gets 200, you might have a good reason to fear this guy. This is a capable warrior. Extremely so. So then the commanders of the Philistines went out to battle, and it happened as often as they went out that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul.